Hi, this is Paula Morrell. Welcome to Tales from the South.
You are my favorite one. You are my favorite one. You are my favorite one.
How's everybody doing tonight? About tonight's music by Amy Garland Angel. Y'all like Amy? Amy Garland and Jeff Coleman merged their musical styles as a powerful duo. They recently filmed a feature scene in the Arkansas-based independent film Valley Inn. Amy has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard on ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock painter Christy Young, and our featured piece is this painting right over here entitled Happy Bike, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Christy at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories are all centered around the truth of the matter, whether it's about an incident, a person, or ourselves. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Bill Fitzgerald grapples with who his new friend really is. And we'll end the night with Daniel Moix as he discovers a difficult truth about himself. But let's start the night with Julia Lee McGill as she struggles with telling the truth about what really happened in Peachtree.
I remember looking up and seeing a spread of branches clawed out like fingers. I remember the feeling of the cold ground on my back. I remember the feeling of losing my breath. In the dreams I've had, my eyes are in the ground and I watch myself falling. I see my face with an open, breathless mouth, my arms thrown wide and my elbows and knees jutting out at broken right angles. I see myself falling from a tall oak with gnarled branches, knowing that at any moment the ground is going to plow into my face. But that's only a dream. I fell watching the heavens, my back towards the earth, falling onto food for worms. There was a blonde boy that was now called my brother, and he hung his head in a way that looked like he spent his days with Soda Pop and Pony Boy. His mother was in nursing school, and my mama liked to call her Mrs. Edward Marion McGill the third, though then I didn't understand why everyone laughed so much. My father was good at everything, like farming catfish, teaching me the finer points of making spaghetti, and listing all the Latin names of plants, though he decided that chapter of his life closed and he didn't do those things anymore. My father became the type of man to only give you his coat when you were at funerals. There is a time to be sad, my father says, and then you should eat a casserole overdone with butter and pity and get on with it. Had he not met God, my father would have made an excellent conservationist. Bound to my father, the blonde boy's mother wanted a house. They bought an unfinished foreclosed house that used to belong to crackheads. They needed my mother, so she lied and signed the court papers that said my father had been paying his child support, something I learned over expensive salads this January. The house had stairs, brass handles on drawers, and a big mirror in the bathroom. There were field mice inside, and while the floors had to be re-sanded and re-polyurethaned, Dad said the wood was good. There were rock stairs in the backyard, a shed that turned into Dad's new business, and a chicken coop with a low ceiling. There was a patch of flat grass that turned into a patch of flat dirt that didn't grow anything but some sunflowers one year, which my dad used to feed some birds he wanted to shoot. The peach tree sat next to the dirt patch, and the blonde boy pushed me out there. I remember the cold that day. I remember wearing a jacket that was a color I did not like. It did not fit me correctly in the arms, and it puffed out my body. I think the day was in early spring, a spring that was coming late. In the tree, I was a cat. I was a cat climbing grayed branches with cold hands. I was a cat, and the blonde boy was a dog, and he ran up to the base of the tree and started barking. I got scared and lost grip. On a branch balanced on all fours, my body swung upside down. The hands let go. I was a cat lying on my back, staring at blue skies. He stood over me. He squatted. His hands clutched a puffy jacket, and my arms could feel it. The silent boy called my brother had a harsh whisper. I'm sure he asked if I were okay. I only remember, don't tell, don't tell. Girls weren't supposed to climb trees. Boys weren't supposed to be playing make-believe. Boys weren't supposed to be playing with little girls. Boys weren't supposed to be playing with little girls alone. Boys weren't supposed to be playing with little girls and hurt little girls, especially alone. And crying made your face ugly. He picked me up in one of those fluid motions where your feet lift off the ground, and I breathed. I held my arm. He was either behind me pushing or holding my other arm and ushering, and I followed. I do not remember where we went. I think there was frost. They found out later. I think I was holding my arm at dinner. I'm sure we were having spaghetti, sitting at that cheap pine dinner table in the dim dining room that led to the carport where all my cats lapped up antifreeze and died. I am sure that my hair was in my mouth and that I was chewing on it while I was chewing my food. I'm sure that was happening because that was what was always happening when they noticed my arm. I lied. The silent boy they called my brother looked at me, and I looked at him. I looked at him the same way I would later look at him over $5 pizzas and video game controllers. I looked at him the same way I would later look at him when he lost his big college scholarship and started working at the grocery store full-time and sleeping with the grocery store girls with bad dye jobs full-time. And I looked at him the way I would later look at him when his trailer got robbed and we talked, and how I couldn't tell him why a rope felt strong in his hands, why he dreamt of the sound of a train hitting his body, or why the moon looks like a pill. I looked at him in a way where my mouth said one thing and my eyes said another.
Julia Lee McGill is an Arkansas native. She studies English and creative writing at Hendricks College in Conway, Arkansas. Next, let's go to New Orleans with Bill Fitzgerald as he takes a new job and discovers a truth about his new friend is elusive in A Piece of My Heart.
When I took a job at a venerable but aged New Orleans ad agency, I was the new blood, the chance to bring the agency into the modern era. I was named a VP, though it was a pretty meaningless title. My art director partner, a new hire as well, was a big, tall, good-looking guy from Buffalo, New York, with a voice even deeper than mine. Rick Baxter and I hit it off, but there was something about him I just couldn't figure out. He'd talk about girls he had dated or even been with, then he'd lisp his way through the telling of last night's adventures in the French Quarter. I was truly confused. He was movie star handsome, my age, he smoked like a chimney, 6'4", blonde hair, blue eyes, a sculptor on the side. I'd think I'd have him figured out, Then he dropped some bomb that just totally sunk my preconceptions, kept me off balance for months. Now, when I was a kid, gay still meant merry and carefree. I'm not sure that's what my uncle, Joe Ledoux, called himself, but it's what he was. I didn't come to realize it until my teens, though I always knew he was different. The fact that he had a male roommate in his house on Kalarek Street in the Faubourg Marigny across Rampart Street from the much gaudier French Quarter seemed to me only a little queer. I mean, odd. I always loved Uncle Joe regardless. He was my godfather as well as my uncle, my very Catholic mother's even more Catholic baby brother. He collected Wedgwood china, Steinway grand pianos, and friends from all walks of life and of all persuasions, except people of dark skin. For all his qualities, he was also a raging racist. I know, weird, right? That someone who in his own right had been judged, marginalized, and discriminated against could be so down on minorities. When I was still just a kid in the Mississippi Delta, maybe 7 or so, my mother wanted me to spend a few days with Uncle Joe at his New Orleans home. My father, Fitz, vetoed it. I found this out much later, after my uncle died a few years ago. Fitz was a country doctor and treated anyone with a temperature, broken bone, or gout just the same. I never got the chance to ask him about it. He and Joe got along fine, and when we moved to New Orleans in my teens, Joe was a frequent and welcome dinner guest, always bringing Fitz his favorite French bread from Galatoire's, or fresh shrimp or crabs from Bucktown. The grown-ups would talk while Joe and my mother collaborated on gumbo or some other delicacy. Did I mention he was an amazing cook? I know, what a cliche, right? I know that outwardly Fitz didn't treat him any different, but he just wasn't okay with me, a little boy, even though we were flesh and blood relatives, spending time alone with a gay man. Now, while Fitz was happy I chose to play high school football and hunt, he never pushed those things on me or any other manly pursuits. He was glad I could cook, dress myself, and treat all women and men with respect and courtesy. And I know that he didn't think Joe was bad. He just couldn't wrap his head around it. Fitz was open-minded, but very conservative at heart, even in his practice. He was on record saying he didn't believe in depression, but as he lay dying from cancer at home, he became a believer, going so far as to ask me to remove all the guns from the family house. If you asked me who the two biggest male influences in my life, I'd say Fitz and Joe, without hesitation. It's funny, they're so different, both so devoted to family, both so kind and caring to me and my family. One, a macho man's man who rode horses, hunted big game, and even killed a bear that threatened his prized hunting hound with a knife. The other, Uncle Joe, of the delicate sauces, the commanding performances on the Steinway, the exquisite collection of 18th century china, and the music at my own wedding. So when I took the VP job at the New Orleans ad agency and got paired with Rick, I was confused. Was he a Fitz or was he an Uncle Joe? I just couldn't figure him out. Rick and I came up with some great ad campaigns for Tabasco, the old K&B drugstore chain, Evita Springs Water. We clicked as a team, and we clicked as friends. So much so that I finally got up the courage to say, "So, Rick, are you gay or what?" Rick had a great laugh at that. When he finally got his breath, he said with all sincerity, "Honey, I'm a big ol' fag." Then we made some Tabasco ads. That's how it was with Rick and me. It was about the work, and it was about our friendship. He was obviously a bachelor, so he was a frequent visitor to our home for dinner, for drinks, or just being with family. He loved family. He loved my family. He and my wife talked dirt like girlfriends. He loved playing with and spoiling my two daughters. His own family, thank God, loved him unconditionally, but they were half a country away. I never met him, but I loved them for that. Our Christmas gift to Rick, the inaugural issues of Martha Stewart's Living. He was moved to tears. Such a cliche. Uncle Joe had a big house in the Faubourg. He rented out the top floor and had just tossed out his last tenant because he hadn't paid rent in 6 months. I wondered why Joe would allow him to go 6 months without paying rent, but the reason is that Joe was a softie, a racist, hyper-Catholic softie. Rick happened to be looking for a new place, so I told him about Joe's. It was right around the corner from one of Rick's favorite dive bars, and it was perfect. The deal was done. No deposit, no lease. Rick was a friend of mine, so that was good enough for Joe. They hit it off. Not like that. I mean, they got to be friends and incredibly tolerant of each other. Joe was more of a busybody homebody, and Rick the swinging single man. They just both happened to be gay. Joe took to calling Rick Baby Baxter and would let Rick know when he heard him come home from the bars at a particularly late hour. Rick and I were on a TV shoot somewhere in New Orleans when he told me the results of his HIV test. We had both fretted about it for days. I must say, he took it a lot better than I did. The director lined up the shot with Rick on one side of him and me on the other. Rick leaned back away from the director and mouthed to me, "I got my results." And I mouthed as frantically as one can mouth, "And?" He just made a plus sign with his fingers. We finished the shoot. I don't really know how, because I wasn't there. I was somewhere in the future, somewhere my big, sweet, handsome friend wasn't. Rick lived another 12 years. He went to another agency and did more great advertising. I had been in Little Rock a few years when a rep for a local film company who did business in New Orleans called me to tell me the news. I was in my glass office. Everybody could see. And what they saw wasn't pretty. Rick would have been amused and called me a big old fag for losing it like that in public, at work, in front of my staff, when we had work to produce. But I bawled like a baby, like I'd lost my best friend, like I'd lost a piece of my heart. He was a big old fag. And I loved him, like a brother, like my own family.
Bill Fitzgerald is a writer, creative director, nephew, uncle, son, father, and brother living in Little Rock. He grew up in the Mississippi Delta, New Orleans, and Idaho, and hopes to never complete that task. In our final story of the night, Daniel Moix realizes a truth about himself, and the changes begin in losing.
Mom, the kids at school pick on me. They call me names. Nowadays, this would prompt a phone call to the principal, a committee meeting, some norming, and an angry Facebook campaign in which everyone changed their profile pictures to something iconic. The response from my mother, a woman who had undergone gastric bypass in the 1970s, was, "Yeah, they used to pick on me too." After a long drag on her cigarette, she'd look off into the distance and say, "Sticks and stones, Danny. Sticks and stones." I've been the poster boy for childhood obesity since practically birth. I had a very loving mother who cooked the way her mother taught her, with lard. I was her only child, and she derived great pleasure from feeding me. Once, she took me to the doctor asking, "Why is my baby orange?" The answer was, "You're feeding him too many carrots." To this day, I still turn a little orange if I eat too many carrots. I was 165 pounds in the third grade. I know this because the physical education teacher, Miss Bogan, rounded up all the fat kids and brought us together for a special class each week where we would weigh in and talk about what we'd eaten that week. In the fourth grade, I vividly recall having to go to another building to use the grown-up scale. I'd grown to 209 pounds. Miss Bogan's actions were well-intentioned, but I felt more singled out and picked on by her than by my peers. One does not simply sail through childhood as heavy set without attracting the attention of bullies, mean kids, and, well, everyone. While bullying has been a buzzword in education for a while, it was something that we just lived with when I was in school. In the fifth grade, I moved to a new home in a new school district, which meant learning a whole new set of bullies. One particularly nasty kid, we'll call him Rodney, nagged, harassed, and verbally exhausted me relentlessly. One day at the tetherball pole, he said something that incensed me. Without thought, my fist was making contact with his nose. What was happening? Now, I'm not a violent person. I never have been, and I hope never to be. But that day on the playground, something inside me came unglued, and Rodney took a direct hit to the face. Minutes later, we were both sitting in the principal's office with our heads hung low. Rodney had a tissue collecting the blood dripping from his nose, and he was the first one to go into the principal's office. I heard some quiet conversation through the door, some very loud paddling, some more exclamations from Rodney, and then silence. A few moments later, Rodney left the principal's office with tears running down his face, reconstituting the caked blood on his cheeks. If this is what they did to the victims of violence in this district, I was going to be mutilated. Very timidly, I entered when called into the principal's office. "Tell me what happened," were the principal's only words. I told him about the history with Rodney and how something just snapped inside me. I started apologizing, making excuses, and doing my best to talk my way out of evisceration, and the principal stopped me mid-sentence and instructed me to sit down. He then told me about his childhood. He shared with me that he had once been the victim of relentless teasing, too. He understood. With a smirk on his face, the principal stood up with his paddle and approached me. I was confused and a bit panicked. "The handbook says the remedy for you hitting someone is that I have to paddle you. The handbook doesn't say how hard I have to paddle you." He swatted me gently and sent me back to class. Playground bullying was solved that day when the kids saw what happened to Rodney. But then came middle school and junior high. Cliques, exclusion, and pranks replaced name-calling. I'd rather have been punched in the face than punched in the heart when I was told that I couldn't sit at a certain table or join a particular study group. I looked at the popular kids who weren't skinny. I analyzed them. I noticed that each and every one of them was humorous, happy, and full of laughs. At that time, I didn't comprehend correlation or causation. It didn't really dawn on me that because they were popular, they were happy. I deduced that because they were boisterous, they were popular. So I set out to reinvent myself as the clown. I was quite good at beating bullies to the punchline of many put-downs. I owned being big and made it part of my personality, my brand. I leveraged my size whenever possible in humorous ways. For the most part, that worked for me. Even as a teacher, I referred to my last name as a unit of size. For instance, the watertight doors on the USS Razorback are less than one moix wide. "I'll stay out here while you go down and tour the exhibit." It hurt a little bit less when the person doing the name calling was me. And then one day, the truth hit me. I was now both the victim and the perpetrator. Ayn Rand once said, "The question isn't who's going to let me, it's who's going to stop me." In retrospect, it's the bullies asking who's going to stop me, and those being bullied asking who's going to let me. That day, I switched from asking to telling. In the past 2 years, I've lost 250 pounds. What I've lost in weight, I've gained in strength. When I see name-calling and bullying among my students, I stop it. When I hear it, I intervene. Whether it's about size, fashion, perceived sexuality, or anything else, I stop it and in full swing. Moreover, I'm very careful about what I say about myself, both aloud and in my head. Oh, and in case you were wondering, Rodney never bothered me again.
Daniel Moix is a 33-year-old educator from Conway, Arkansas. Daniel weighed nearly 450 pounds before setting off on his weight loss journey, which he blogs about at needlesspounds.com. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Here's a song about my very first kiss, Mr. Billy Thompson from Heflin, Louisiana. Well, Billy Thompson was a rambler. He gave me my first kiss to a Kenny Rogers record when I was just a kid. He was 3 years older, and in my brother's grade, he was tall and blonder than the boys my age. Had it so bad.
So bad.
I had it so bad.
So bad.
When we slow down, in my parents' garage. It's the song I